Join the conversation at everydaynovelist.com. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find the host at J.D. Sawyer on Minds.com, or hit him up at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 856.
Today we hear from a fiendish disputant who has gloriously graced my inbox with many long essays recently and provided endless hours of delight. Ed asks,
"You mentioned you'd had some frontline experience with cult members.
Oh boy.
In fantasy worlds, the heroes just kill all the cultists. In the real world, how do you defeat a cult?"
Well, probably the short answer is that you don't. You can escape it. You can sometimes help someone escape. But you know, cults exist for some pretty basic reasons. They're the perfect storm of an artificial family and a cosmogony, which is a story that gives order to the universe. Cults have their own self-contained mythoses, and the combination of family and cosmogony is almost unbreakable. That's how people derive meaning in the universe, is their family and their understanding of the world, whether that family is their birth family or a family that they have when they grow up and they partner up and they have children, or it's a chosen family. Family is what social organisms like us need in order to feel like we're not alone in a very uncaring universe, and the cosmogony is what we need to allow us to feel like our lives can have meaning even though we know that they will end. And the two interface a lot. The things that make cults dangerous is that they deliberately prey upon this need in a way that encourages the abrogation of self. And if you want to escape a cult, or you want to help someone escape a cult, you have to help them find themselves, those parts of themselves that are distinct from the cult. And that's a delicate process. Sometimes that's relational. Sometimes that's cognitive. Oftentimes it's both. The first step on the road to escaping a cosmogony happens when you allow a non-conforming idea to persist. The cognitive mechanism by which we control non-conforming ideas is called cognitive dissonance reduction. Cognitive dissonance is what happens when you get two ideas that are mutually exclusive, and you can't resolve which one's true or how. Normally what happens in this case is whichever idea is closer to the already accepted worldview gets a pass on credit, so to speak. It gets a statutory win. It's like the referees at the end of a boxing match saying, okay, well, no one knocked anyone out, but this guy wins on points. The stuff that confirms what you already believe wins on points. It's Bayesian reasoning. It's the basis of human reasoning. Everybody does it. When something enters your awareness that contradicts your worldview, but that you cannot dismiss, because perhaps it opens a piece of the world that has previously not made sense and that your worldview can't make sense of, you've taken the first step on the road to apostasy. This is true whatever you're apostatizing from, whether it's a religion or an ideology or a piece of a worldview or a value that you hold dear, whatever it is. Now, the other thing about cults is that they have leaders, and leaders are fallible. And so a lot of the attrition from cults comes when people see that the leaders do not seem really to believe what they're saying. And that evidence usually comes from the leader's behavior rather than their speech. when the leader appears to advocate a particular moral program or a particular understanding of the spiritual nature of the universe or what have you, but is somehow always doing things that are kind of incompatible with that. If, for example, the leader says that helping the poor is all that matters and that community solidarity is the will of God, and yet the leader continues to get richer and richer and more distant from the followers and more exploitative of the followers, well, then you've got Jim Jones and a lot of other such leaders. But that growing disconnect between the dogma and the behavior of the prophet is one of the surest ways that you can tell that a cult is on its road to either group suicide or dissolution. But cults generally don't get defeated from the outside. They get defeated from the inside. In fantasy worlds, you defeat them by killing the leader or by bringing in a superior magic that proves the leader's a fraud or that proves the leader's evil. And analogously, that kind of thing happens in real life. But usually, cults break up when they make hard contact with reality in a way that they cannot rationalize away. That's true whether it's for the individual believer or for the cult as a group. When a cult as a group does that, you have one of two things happen. It either dissolves or it becomes a religion. You see this in the second generation of the Mormon Church. You see it in the second generation of the Christian Church. I know the Christian Church history best, so I'll give you the quick and dirty. But every other cult that becomes a religion that I have had a chance to look closely at follows something of this kind of pattern. The prophet dies or is discredited. And the followers don't want to give up the community. They still believe in the ideas, even if the person who is championing those ideas has shown themselves to be vulnerable or fallible in some way. Like, for example, dying or getting nailed for embezzlement or sexual abuse or what have you. So the group carries on, and from within the movement, usually from the edges of the movement, a new prophet arises who has a philosophical or theological agenda that is geared around bringing the cult into a kind of equilibrium with the world around them. The theology becomes more pragmatic. Even if the idealism is still there, there's an acknowledgement that we may not be of the world, but we have to live in the world. So rather than concentrating on absolute purity of doctrine or purity of behavior, a more pragmatic approach tends to prevail. And usually you have a split between the esoteric and the exoteric, which in early stage cults, there's no division between these things. The esoteric is the internal spiritual life, and the exoteric is the publicly preached doctrine and the public practice of the believer. And that split between the exoteric and the esoteric is what characterizes a mature religion. You see this starting to happen now with Scientology, as Scientology is one of those rare cults that actually made it a full two generations as a genuine cult. But it's lost its power. It's now trying to become, in fact, what it always pretended to be at the beginning. It always pretended to be a self-help organization. But now that you have all of the defections and the publishing of the secret documents and of the chicanery they got up to in the 70s, 80s, and 90s with the fair game policy and other fun stuff like that, the fact remains that a lot of people who were on the fringes of the church, who weren't part of the internal core, weren't part of the Sea Org, found it a very good operating philosophy to live by, for one reason or another. They found it gave structure and meaning to their lives. So you're starting to get splinter Scientology movements that aren't centered around David Miscavige or L. Ron Hubbard directly, but are centered around the auditing and the quasi-psychotherapeutic elements that helped them overcome their dyslexia or helped them get off drugs or, in other ways, order their mental universe. And so I think Scientology is probably going to wind up being a long-haul religion. Same kind of thing happened with the Mormons when the focus under Brigham Young started to shift from the apocalyptic message of the prophet to the solidarity of the community based in family life. Not a lot of the doctrine changed, but the focus of the community life changed from the ecstatic to the practical. So, yeah, like I said, the short answer is you don't defeat a cult. Best you can hope to do is domesticate it. And cults do tend to domesticate themselves after between 1 and 3 generations if they don't die out entirely. Meantime, if you know someone who is in a cult or who is involved in an ideology that strikes you as being like a cult, even if it doesn't have all the features, if it has that totalizing effect on their thinking, the best thing you can do to help them is to be their friend and to be willing to spar with them about ideas and keep it on the level of ideas. Don't impugn them because you think their ideology is immoral. That kind of argument almost never works. The only people it works on are people who already think that it might be immoral but believe it anyway because they think it's true. Don't attack people on the moral level because people get defensive. If you want to change someone's thinking, you show them respect and you create opportunities for them to discover the cognitive dissonance that they're already carrying around. And then when it comes up, you validate it. You give them the opportunity not to suppress it right away. But you don't push. You have to let them solve it on their own. Because if you push too hard, best case is they just change their cultic allegiance to a new ideology, maybe one that you happen to be advocating. And in the long run, it may be a more healthy ideology, but you haven't helped a person become free and become the owner of their own self and their own mind. And if you love somebody, or even if you just respect them and care about them, to my way of thinking, you owe them the dignity of their own free will. They must choose their own path, not be jostling between different masters to enslave their mind. But I'm kind of opinionated about these things, so I may be a bit strident. And I'll have a couple of links down in the show notes, which you'll find either in your podcatcher or at everydaynovelist.com, for books dealing specifically with cults and how they work psychologically and that sort of thing, so that you can have further resources. Thank you very much for the question, Ed. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.